This episode of the Gospel Coalition podcast is brought to you by Operation Christmas Child, whose gift-filled shoeboxes will result in evangelism and discipleship for more than 4 million children this year. Learn how to pack a shoebox and find your drop-off at samaritanspurse.org/OCC. National Collection Week is November 12 to 19. This is the Gospel Coalition podcast, where we seek to renew the contemporary church in the ancient gospel of Jesus Christ. I'm your host, Colin Hansen. If their intent were to foster anger and conflict, college administrators are doing an excellent job. The rise of safe spaces hasn't proven so safe for students, speakers, and professors who question the progressive orthodoxy of today's academy. In many university settings today, students are encouraged to assume the worst of others, to assume that they and their friends alone are fighting evil on behalf of good, and to assume that they cannot withstand criticism or challenge from ideas they don't like. As you might imagine, that's a recipe for endless quarrels. But it's not just a problem with anger and conflict we see in these settings today. It's also rising rates of anxiety and depression among students, and no wonder. In his new book, The Coddling of the American Mind, How Good Intentions and Bad Ideas Are Setting Up a Generation for Failure, Jonathan Haidt and co-author Greg Lukianoff of the Foundation for Individual Rights in Higher Education argue that campus leaders have promoted three great untruths. They are, number one, the untruth of fragility, what doesn't kill you makes you weaker. Number two, the untruth of emotional reasoning, always trust your feelings. Number three, the untruth of us versus them. Life is a battle between good people and evil people. Haidt, a previous guest on the Gospel Coalition podcast for his book, The Righteous Mind, argues that we're facing some long-standing problems with a new twist. He and Greg write, "What is new today is the premise that students are fragile. Even those who are not fragile themselves often believe that others are in danger and therefore need protection." Haidt is the Thomas Cooley Professor of Ethical Leadership at New York University's Stern School of Business. He's also the author of The Happiness Hypothesis, which I recommend. Thank you for joining me again, Jonathan, on the Gospel Coalition podcast.
Well, thank you, Colin. It's a pleasure to be back.
So when did you realize that something had changed in campus life in particular, and then our popular discourse at large?
It was in roughly January of 2014. I had spent my whole career teaching at the University of Virginia in the psychology department. And in 2011, I moved to NYU, to the Stern School of Business. And I didn't do a lot of teaching my first couple of years. But once I started teaching a large lecture class with hundreds of students, strange things started happening. Students started objecting to videos that I showed, to images that I showed, that I'd been showing for 10 or 15 years. Suddenly, these images, like, for example, one was an image to illustrate weakness of the will and temptation. I showed a painting about from the Odyssey, where Ulysses ties himself to the mast, and the sirens are climbing up onto the boat, and the sirens are topless because, you know, sirens and mermaids don't tend to wear shirts and bras and things. So somebody, you know, it's just showing a painting, and somebody objected that it was sexist, that it was inappropriate, and it was just very strange. And at first I thought, wow, what's with these NYU students? But no, it wasn't NYU, it was the generation. Some new ideas began to appear in 2013 to 2014 is when they first really begin to show up. We start reading the first reports in newspapers about students requesting trigger warnings, safe spaces, talking about microaggressions. So something changed rather suddenly around 2014 plus or minus. And that's what Greg Lukianoff first noticed, came to talk to me about. I had noticed it too. And that led us to work together to write this article in 2015 titled The Coddling of the American Mind, which came out in The Atlantic.
So let's talk about some of what led to that rather surprising and sudden shift. I know it's overly simplistic to blame iPhones alone. Mm-hmm. But you do find them to be a significant, or smartphones in general, to be a significant factor here. The timing and the changes isn't coincidental. Is that the, let's talk then as we even begin to start working towards some solutions. Is that the easiest change we could make to begin to wean young people off their smartphones, as if that might be possible?
No, I don't think it is, because I'm wrestling with it right now with my 12-year-old son, and I'm trying to get his friends' parents to work with me on this. It's really hard. Maybe we should, let's just back up for a moment and say there are a lot of causal threads that came together to cause this relatively rapid change. Now, first, let me make clear, it's not as though the whole generation has suddenly lost its mind, not at all. It's rather just that some new ideas, some really bad ideas, have become very popular, very common. And the question is, why are students believing that they're so fragile that they can be harmed by books and words and speakers? And so the analysis that we offer, the conclusion we came to, is that there are six different trends, iPhones and social media being one of them. But others include that there's rising political polarization in this country with increasing left-right hatred, and boy, that's going to be hard to reverse. There's a rise in paranoid parenting. We really freaked out in America about people kidnapping our kids, and we clamped down on them, and we kept them inside, and we don't let them outside unsupervised. That, I think, is actually the most important one for us to change, and that is one that I think really can change. So that's where I'd prefer to focus. Another is the rise of social media, which has really profound effects on all of our institutions. A lot of our churches and synagogues and corporations are experiencing extraordinary conflict from social media. So we need to do something about that, but that's going to be a lot harder. So it's a really complicated and interesting problem, but I'd actually prefer that we talk about what we've done to our children first.
Yeah. So, well, which would also include things like, I mean, the paranoid parenting trend does relate to the smartphones, right? Because that's at least an excuse that a lot of parents give toward why their children need them, so that they can be accessible, so that they can monitor them at all times.
Well, that's true. That's true. But the crackdown began in the 1990s. Before the smartphones. So kids who were certainly raised in the 70s and well into the 80s would go out and play. And the parents wouldn't know where they are. And that's crucial that the kids know there's no safety net, that if they get lost, they have to ask someone for directions and find their way home. And if they fall off their bicycle and skin their knee, they have to limp home or get help. It's absolutely crucial that children have thousands of opportunities to be independent, face problems, and resolve them themselves. Thousands before they go to college. And what we've done now is that kids aren't allowed out until, you know, it depends on the town, but typically around 13, 14, 15 is when we let kids out on their own. That's crazy. It's totally crazy to deprive kids of experience of independence until they're 15.
Yeah, and you've talked about this quite a bit. Why don't we take a step back? Because I think a lot of people are going to be surprised by what you're saying there. I mean, we hear a little bit about free-range parenting, but you tie it back to our media culture in part, correct? Because of the way that a few incidents that are extraordinarily rare,
right,
unlikely to happen,
yes,
became almost the default expectation that if we don't keep our kids inside or keep an eye on them at all time, they'll be the next kids on the milk cartons.
That's right. So there was a real crime wave in the 1960s through the 1990s, but it was over by the mid-1990s, and it never really affected children. So kids were not really kidnapped more in the 70s or 80s than they are today. It's extremely rare. But what happened was every story, once we got cable TV around 1980, 81, every story was in our face 24 hours a day for days or weeks. And so the human mind, so I'm a social psychologist, we think a lot about cognitive biases, and there's what's called the availability heuristic. So if you think about a kid being kidnapped or abducted and raped and tortured and killed, you know, we've all seen a few cases of that. There are a few cases of that, you know, every year in a country with 350 million people. So it's almost certain to not happen to your kid, but it's so available to your consciousness. And so when you think, well, what would I take a million to one odds of my kid being murdered, you know, abducted and murdered? Well, if you think rationally, of course you should. Of course you should. You should never restrict your child because of a million to one odd. But emotionally, of course you shouldn't. Of course you shouldn't take that chance. So, you know, we cracked down when there was actually no real threat.
Let's talk about the shift from intent to impact, and how that's contributed to hostile discourse. And this is something else that I see pretty often, and I think I started to see it around the same time that you're describing right here. The way that it became popular for somebody to say that words or ideas, quote-unquote, make them physically ill, mm-hmm. or that your beliefs can deny someone or some group the quote-unquote right to exist.
Yeah, that's one of the most florid of the new rhetorical formulations. So I think what we need to see happening is that social life involves all kinds of games. You know, like maybe I'm expecting to play tennis and I go out onto the tennis court and you're on the other side and I hit the ball to you and then you tackle me. And I'm like, what are you doing? Wait, that's not the game. Well, in the same way, what's kind of happening to us now is in various format, in various situations where you might, you know, say you're in a class and you offer a competing hypothesis. Well, you know, how do we know that this was caused by prejudice, or how do we know? And somebody then tackles you because they're not playing the truth-seeking game. They're playing the political warfare game. And so people are using language in ways not to relate or connect or find truth, but to fight battles. Now, that's normal in some contexts. We're all very skilled. I mean, especially if you had a sibling and you grew up, you're very skilled at presenting your case to your mom and dad to make it maximally clear that you're innocent and she's guilty. So, but that's a rhetorical trick. And so what we're seeing on campus now is students saying that words are violence, that if a speaker were to come to campus, and sometimes, it, you know, it's Christian speakers, because one of the central battles on campus is over LGBT rights. Right. And this is a very important topic to discuss. And we're, you know, we're all trying to work out how to give everybody rights to access and dignity. But when people see, well, there's a battle over this issue, if somebody were to come and speak on the other side of it, it's not just that I would dislike that speaker, it's that that is a threat. That person's words would be violence, and therefore I need to be protected from it. It's a matter of safety.
Yeah, that's something that actually happened to one of our conference speakers and writers, Jackie Hill Perry, a woman who is now married with children, but who had previously identified as lesbian speaking at Harvard University recently. It was as if she were advocating a form of physical violence. That's mm-hmm. how angry people were. And that was the pretense which people offered to be able to explain why she should not be allowed on campus, though she did end up going through with that. From a Christian perspective, I mean, Christians are compelled by Jesus himself to evangelize, to share the good news of his death and resurrection for sinners. We see it as the greatest act of love we can offer to our neighbors, but I can't imagine that that goes over well among some of the students and administrators given these trends that you're talking about. So how would you recommend that Christians obey this command in such hostile and yet at the same time sensitive environments?
Yeah. Yes, it's a big challenge. We live in a time of moral incoherence. Now, Western societies have long been somewhat incoherent. The more you have diversity of religion, of perspective, with more you have immigration, the more you risk having the Tower of Babel. Now, let me be clear: immigration and diversity have many good effects. I'm Jewish. My grandparents came here from the old country. While Christians had to adapt to Jews in many ways, I think it's clear that Jews have contributed a great deal to the intellectual life of this country and to many other areas. So I'm not anti-immigration. I'm not anti-diversity. But what I'm saying is we all need to understand that there are pluses and minuses of all of these things. Getting back to your question now. So we live in a time of increasing incoherence. In these times, it's an invitation to people who are looking for a sense of meaning and purpose. I think we're seeing many students on campus searching for a sense of meaning and purpose, and they find it in fighting for the rights of marginalized and oppressed people. And that means they often cast Christians as the enemy of LGBT people, and they cast Jews as the enemy of Muslims, or the Palestinians specifically, I should say. So Christians need to understand that the campus environment, not universally, but at least at the elite schools and especially on the coasts, the campus environment is very politicized. It's very much about fighting for a particular conception of social justice. So my advice is that this is not a fight that a minority group, or if Christians are a minority on campus, it's not a fight that a group can win directly or would want to win directly. My first thought for you is that Christianity has enormous moral resources that are in great need right now, and those are humility and forgiveness. I think as soon as you say those words, almost everybody realizes, wow, yeah, the social media landscape, the political landscape, my God, what a mess. Wouldn't it be great if people were a little bit more humble, a little bit more forgiving? So I think that Christians, I mean, my advice, again, let's talk about whether this makes sense, but my advice would be just do what you do best. Model the virtues that Christianity really gives you, the places where you have a particular moral strength. And it's by taking indirect routes. As you know from my first book, the mind is divided into parts that sometimes conflict, like a rider on an elephant. And I think displays of virtue speak to the elephant. The elephant is our emotional, intuitive processes. If you can appeal to people by your example, then you can reason with them much better afterwards.
There were a number of statistics in this book that were really jarring. One in particular stood out to me. You say adults in authority are trying to help in these situations, but they're actually making things worse and unintentionally promoting mental approaches common in anxiety and depression. So this is the stat. In the change from millennials to iGen, now, 1 in 7 women in U.S. universities says she has a psychological disorder, compared to 1 in 18 just a few years earlier. Help us understand what's going on.
That's right. This is completely stunning, shocking. So on college campuses, some of your listeners may have heard stories in the newspaper. College campuses, the mental health clinics are flooded. There are long lines. Now, does this mean that the young generation, so not the millennials, we're not talking about millennials here. The millennial generation is those born between 1982 and 1994. The problems are for the next generation. It's kids born in 1995 and after. They have much, much higher rates of anxiety and depression. Not schizophrenia, not any other disorder, just anxiety and depression. And one thought is, well, you know, maybe they're just more willing to talk about it. They were raised with psychotherapy, and there's no real change. They just are happy to seek help, and isn't that good? But the answer is no, it's not just an illusion like that, because if you look at the rates at which kids are being admitted to hospitals for slitting their wrists or cutting their skin, it also has shot way up, especially for girls. Same thing for the suicide rate. The girls' suicide rate for adolescent girls is up about 80% since the early 2000s, 80%. So what we're seeing on college campuses is part of a national trend in which teenagers are much more depressed and anxious, and it's concentrated among the girls. It's much bigger among the girls. And so now we can get back to your question about social media. Because that is the leading culprit. We don't know for sure why this is, but the leading idea is that if you give boys an iPhone, and that basically happened around 2009, 2010, most teenagers got an iPhone or a smartphone. And when boys suddenly all get smartphones, what do? They do what my son does. They sit around on the bed playing games in which they kill people, but they're working as a team to kill people. And so it's kind of fun, and it involves some teamwork, and they are talking to each other. So it turns out video games and iPhones aren't that bad for boys. But what are the girls doing? Girls' aggression has always been relational. It's not physical. They don't push each other and hit each other. They damage each other's relationships. And if you give everybody an iPhone and social media and Snapchat and Instagram, what they do is they can bully each other, they can damage each other's relationships, and they can show off how well-connected they are. Oh, look at me with all these popular girls, and you're not there. So the social media effects on girls have been really devastating.
Yeah, another opportunity there for Christians to talk about what it means to be made in the image of God and to identify with Christ. That was just something as I was reading it, despite the fact that we come from a little bit of some different perspectives on these things, where I could see there are ways for Christians to make a real difference here in light of these distressing things that are happening.
You ask me another question, tell me how I would love to explore this with you. Are there, just as you know, Christians have certain virtues that are in short supply now, is there a Christian approach to social media? I mean, how would a Christian parent a girl through this age?
Well, it's interesting. I'm taking a more negative approach on these things, that perhaps there are some things that are just not conducive to health. So, for example, on Snapchat specifically, which has been in significant decline there, I have a friend who's a youth pastor, and so he sees these things way before most other people see them, mm-hmm. because he can see the trends happen. And most youth pastors are just a little bit older than the kids, and they and also that they don't have much experience. But this guy is about 40 years old, and he's been doing this for quite a while, so he sees these things. But one of the things he finds is that with Snapchat in particular, parents just have absolutely no idea happens there. And so he says, you know, how many of your kids have a smartphone, use Snapchat? Well, I mean, it's almost universal, the use of things like sexting. And they're not solicited. So it just helping parents to understand, do you realize this is what's happening there? I think one of the important things for Christians is to understand what we would describe, or what some theologians would describe, as the expulsive power of a new affection. That you can't fight things just by taking them away. You have to give them something greater. And so one of the things that I've been talking with a number of different people about and working toward, and I think of as a father with some younger kids, is just to understand the things that we, the trade-offs in life, the positives that we don't get to experience when we, say, for example, spend all of our time with our friends on Snapchat, what you don't see of God's creation outdoors, of what you don't see of his work with people and learning from people who are not like you and being able to serve them and to love others as Christ has loved you, of being able to have a family that's full of joy and a place of safety. One thing that comes up regularly is this idea that, especially for girls like you're talking about there, they can't hide anymore. The home is not a refuge for them, because the home is where they retreat into their bedroom and get on Snapchat or on whatever there. And so being able to talk about family as a place for those people who will love you no matter who you are and no matter what you do there, and also being able to find community in a church where people can be brought together across political lines, across racial lines, across experience, class, and things like that, because they all believe in the gospel of Jesus. So those are some of the resources. So it's not just saying take this away, though that may very well be the most appropriate thing to do. And then at the same time, though, to show, but look at all of this love, look at this world, look at this place of joy. That's at least what we've been trying to do. It's funny. I mean, I work in technology and media. That's why we're doing this. But for my son and for my daughter, what I've done is I've gone back to the old hymnal, you know, for using those things. We've gone back to catechesis. So we actually had an online version of our New City Catechism. We now have a print version of that. So it's almost like in a digital area, we're trying to figure out where to go analog, but without becoming Amish. Right.
Colin, this is great. Wait, this is wonderful, because I think we can see a way forward here. So what I'd like to add is, speaking as a social psychologist, kids, when they're very young, your kids, they're focused on you and your wife. But by the time they reach about the age of 8 or 9, they're going to be much more concerned about what other kids are doing and saying. And so if it's one parent cracking down, and as I'm trying to do with my son, who's 12, my daughter, who's 8, saying, no, I'm putting this program on your phone to limit you to 2 hours a day. You get 2 hours a day, you decide what you do, but it's 2 hours a day, so you can't waste the whole day scrolling through stuff. But then he kind of resents that. None of it. He says, but none of my friends have that. I'm the only one. Well, yeah, that's why I'm now trying to contact your friends' dads to try to get them to join me. Yeah. So Christians are much more likely to be in a community already and in contact with each other. And so I think if this would be my top message to your listeners with kids, organize, talk with all the other parents. If you can make it a norm in your community that, you know, pick up what the specifics are, like no smartphone until you're 10 or 11, and then only if you're walking to school by yourself. That's sort of what we try to do here in New York City. But maybe you could hold off till you're 12 or 13 there. No social media at all until you're 15. Like no Snapchat. Texting is fine. One-way conversation, two people talking is fine, like we used to do on the phone with our friends when we were kids. It's anything where you put something out and then dozens or hundreds of people can comment on it. That's what's really bad, especially for girls. So if you can say none of that until you're 15 or 16, nobody. If you do it as a group, as a community, then it can stick. And then you bring in all the positives that you just mentioned. So it's not just we're taking this stuff away, but we as a community, we're organizing. The play dates out in the woods or in somebody's backyard with a stream or whatever it is, you take some stuff away, but you emphasize the positives as well. And if you do it as a community, I think it's going to work a lot better than if, I'm just here trying to do it with my two kids and they're saying that I'm a freak.
Right. One of our leading writers on parenting, a very popular message for our listeners called Raising an Alien Child. And it's interesting, we in the West think of Christians as the mainstream. But as we know from Christianity's origins, that was certainly not the case. So much of what we read about in the New Testament is addressed to a community that finds themselves as strangers, as aliens in this world. We specifically see that message in 1 Peter. And so part of the message for Christians, at least, and like you're talking about here, other religious minorities in America have had to think of themselves that way already. Like they had to understand this is what it means. And I know this is a big debate among Jews in particular, but this is what it means to be this kind of religion or this kind of family in this kind of culture that doesn't support it. But Christians haven't always had to think that way. I want to jump in on a couple other things because there's so much ground in this book that's just worth considering. Again, the book is The Coddling of the American Mind, and I'm talking with Jonathan Haidt here. Explain the difference between seeking uniform outcomes as opposed to opportunities in the fight for social justice.
Yes. So social justice is probably the central moral term on campuses. I'm talking about secular campuses, especially elite schools and liberal arts colleges where students live together and form a moral community. Social justice is the central term. And unfortunately, it's a kind of a culture war term now, where a lot of people on the right love to attack it and say, oh, social justice is, Marxism and postmodernism. And then people on the left think that if you're opposed to us, you must be racist and sexist. And so what we do in the book, what Greg Lukianoff and I do in chapter 11 of our book, is we go into the psychology of justice and we say, There are a couple of different psychological systems that give us a sense of justice, and the main one is a sense of proportionality. Even little kids recognize that if you did more work, you should get more of the reward, and if you didn't do any of the work, you shouldn't get the reward. And so a sense of fairness is proportionality everybody gets. People should we should treat people fairly, and that's mostly what that means. People also understand procedural justice, that we shouldn't exclude people based on their category. We should treat people fairly, give them voice and a chance to say what they're concerned about. So as long as we're treating people well, with dignity, and as long as we are giving them equal opportunities so that they can succeed or fail based on their efforts, then almost everybody perceives that as fair. Now, that's what we call proportional procedural social justice, kind of a unfortunately long name, but it's psychologically what there is. And so everybody would agree if people can't apply for a job because of their race, well, that's terrible. That's unfair. That's unjust. And so the social justice folks, they do point out places that are maybe less obvious where there still is racial discrimination in this country, even though we've gotten rid of the worst, most obvious cases. So there is a need for it. The problem is that many people on campus seem to have converged on a definition of what they call structural racism or structural sexism, where if they point, let's say they say, hey, look at the CEOs of companies, only 10% of them are women. Well, that clearly is sexist. Or if they say, look at the programmers, tech people at Google and Apple, only 20% of them are women. That shows that there's structural sexism. That's not legit. That is not right. That is not an accurate diagnosis. That just means you're going to be angry and tilting at windmills forever and ever, because there are a lot of reasons why people choose different careers. There are a lot of reasons why we see different outcomes in society. So our argument is that a lot of the conflicts on campus are due to the fact that certain portions of the students and faculty on the left have chosen a criteria or a definition for justice that is impossible to reach. And that is that everything will be exactly proportional. So everything will be 50% female, 15% black, 15% Hispanic. And that there will be no bad incidents. So if there, you know, if there's ever an incident, a person acts in a racist way, that shows that the whole place is systemically racist or sexist. And those are impossible criteria to reach. Things are getting better. We are achieving much greater equality, especially equality of opportunity. And racism and sexism are going way down. But you wouldn't know that on many campuses.
Yeah, there's a central tension in Christian theology. It's often described as inaugurated eschatology.
What's that?
Yeah, I'll explain it. The idea is that as Christ came, he inaugurated, he started, the kingdom has come in him, as he talks about in the Lord's Prayer. And yet it is not already consummated.
It's not yet consummated.
I should say. So the kingdom of God is among us. And yet not until Christ returns again will it be fully complete. And so there are always tensions for Christians because they want to say, with the power of the Holy Spirit and in the name of Jesus Christ, under the provision of God the Father, we go forth and we seek to bring justice and mercy and reform. And so we know from history all kinds of amazing examples of this. And yet it's kind of like curing cancer. You can cure cancer, which will be wonderful, and then we'll die of something else.
Something else, right.
Until the kingdom has finally come in its fullness. And so you find this tension often among Christians of who is pushing on the already of the kingdom and who is pushing on the not yet. And who is trying to hold them into tension to say, yes, push for that reform. Yes, try to cure cancer. But just know that when you do, there will always be something else there. So it's a way of complaining about the way certain people are restricted or being concerned about the certain injustices that people face, and yet recognizing that there will always be problems in a fallen world. I think that can bring some proportion, that can bring some sense of proportion as well to these conversations. But again, those are categories that Christians are going to have to help to propagate that have been lost.
Well, that's right. Well, especially if you take that same sensibility about the world and the ability to live with its complexity and you apply it to yourself. And that's why,
exactly.
So the happiness hypothesis, chapter 4, is on hypocrisy, and no one has ever said it better than to say, why do you complain about the speck in your neighbor's eye when you do not notice the plank in your own? I mean, that is psychologically right on target. And so if we can understand that the world we live in is not perfect, most people are trying to make it better, we can't know. We have these quick judgments about how we're right and our side is right and the other side is wrong, but we can't even know that. We tend to exaggerate the faults in others and minimize those in ourselves. And so again, I think Christians come to this mess of our current culture with certain moral resources that are in short supply and in great need.
Yeah, I think there's just a couple more questions here, but noteworthy. It was on one of these campuses that you that you're talking about here that I was introduced to Russian literature, and it feels like the Russians, in some cases at least, have helped us to understand those points of what you were quoting there from Jesus, specifically Solzhenitsyn from the 20th century, the line of good and evil going through every man's heart and not between groups of people. I know that's something that you've picked up on quite a
that's
bit
right.
as well. And I always come back to Dostoevsky and his parody of the revolutionary spirit. Humanity I love, it's just humans I hate.
Wow, that's right.
But it's just guided me through a lot of these different things to bring some perspective. Like I said, just a couple more questions here. You ask a fascinating question in the book. Here it is. What happens when you train students to see others and themselves as members of distinct groups defined by race, gender, and other socially significant factors, and you tell them that those groups are eternally engaged, in a zero-sum conflict over status and resources? Well, what's the answer?
That's right. Yeah, so this is one of the big problems I think that we have on campus is certain political ideas have become popular. in which students are taught to see everything through the lens of power and privilege. And those are real categories. People who are powerful often do act to preserve their power. So a Marxist approach to analysis is sometimes valid. The problem is that people love to latch on to a single lens. And when you look at everything through that lens, it distorts reality. As surely as if you looked at everything through a Freudian lens, where you were told everything is sex, or through an economic lens, where you're told everything is money. No, everything is not one thing. Life is complicated. And so if we're creating these communities that are really diverse and on all campuses now, we're really trying, on Christian campuses as well, we're trying to increase representation of people of color, of by gender. So diversity brings many good effects, but if you do it wrong, you're just creating a tinderbox. You're putting people together who could easily misunderstand each other, who could easily get into conflict if they don't give each other the benefit of the doubt. And then how do we train them? We don't say, here, read the Sermon on the Mount, be humble and modest, give each other the benefit of the doubt. No, we don't do that. We say, let's train you about microaggressions, power, and privilege. Let's train you to see the white people are the bad people and the black people are the good people, or whatever it is. You know, just there's all these dimensions. Male is bad, female is good. So if you're training students to think and see in binary ways, where one side is bad and the other is good, it's like you're creating a potential tinderbox. And rather than getting things to work together well and getting something new to grow out of it, you're throwing matches in it. And so that's our argument about how some ideas, some political ideas, while they may have some merit in certain contexts, are played up to such an extent that they make diversity backfire.
Last question I want to ask you here is, why are we morally more compelled to hate than to love?
So I would say let's look at the context. In our personal lives, I don't know that that's true. In other words, in our personal lives, we feel a very powerful need for love. We seek love. If you look at what the average teenager or young adult is doing, how much of their time is spent trying to hate people and how much of it is spent trying to find friends and lovers and a potential spouse? So at the individual level, at the personal level, love is very, very important, and it's probably more important than hate, and it's a bigger part of people's lives, at least arguably for most people, I think. But when we talk about our interactions in public, in the social square or on social media, now what we're talking about is not your deep need for relationship, it's your need for prestige. We all live in what you might call an economy of prestige, in which certain actions will gain you prestige in the eyes of others and certain will lose you prestige. And this is where social media has really messed us up, because if you are online or in any sort of public forum and you say, you know what, the people on the other side actually just did something good, you know, and actually, you know, even though I don't like them a lot of ways, they actually came through here. We should praise them for that. Like, wow, will you be attacked? You are going to be completely savaged. So you don't get, you'll be called a traitor. And so in the public space, which is more dominated by the game of warfare or an understanding of us versus them, there I would agree that hate trumps love, or at least it certainly is more common. It generally gets you more prestige. Now, again, it's possible that within a Christian community, which has different moral resources, the example of loving your enemies could gain you prestige as opposed to being attacked.
Yeah, it can sometimes, but Christians are subject to all of those same tribal dynamics.
They're people too, yeah.
And that social media that you were talking about right there. But that's why I wanted to have this conversation with you and wanted to explore these things with you. And again, I've found your work and just the times that we've shared here on this podcast to be so stimulating and to formative in how I approach these issues, because the happiness hypothesis is different, where you're trying to really bring these resources of social psychology to bear on the great religious teachings of history, including of Jesus, not exclusively Jesus, but including him. But I found in so much of your other work, especially The Righteous Mind, but also now The Coddling of the American Mind, of much that resonates with Christian theology, despite coming from some different both religious and scientific perspectives there. And so I'm grateful for that.
Okay. Well, thank you, Colin. Thanks for giving me this chance to talk to your listeners. I hope they'll visit thecoddling.org. We'll have some resources there and some more things about the book. And I hope they'll make some progress on getting some control over the social media landscape that their kids are being raised in.
We'll get back to you on that one. Again, my guest on the Gospel Coalition podcast has been Jonathan Haidt and his co-authored book, The Coddling of the American Mind, How Good Intentions and Bad Ideas Are Setting Up a Generation for Failure. Thank you, Jonathan.
Thank you, Colin.
You've been listening to the Gospel Coalition podcast. For more gospel-centered resources, visit thegospelcoalition.org. Support for this podcast comes from listeners like you. Learn more and join us at tgc.org/donate.